You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 223. Podcast. I'm Adam White. I'm recording for you in my lovely basement, filled with baby toys and assorted winter boots crap that we have started to unload from the closet. Joining me in places that I assume are not under a deluge are Mr. John Gentile down in Philadelphia. Hi, John.
We barely missed it, man. It was like 20 degrees today, but New York, and I guess where you are, Adam, they're getting like literally like 5 feet a day, like literally 5 feet a day. Man, I used to love snow when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Now, I don't want no snow at all. No snow. Yo-yo. No snow. I can't stand it.
We got some. Roads are a little bit of a mess. I mean, we're on the other side of the lake from Buffalo, and really all the horrible things go to Buffalo. So, you know, Buffalo's buried. And now I'd say, John, I am so happy that we've got Mr. Mark Little with us. I mean, I hate that Ricky Frankel. I can't stand him.
Ricky's
I can't stand
a dick,
his voice.
Man. Ricky's
I mean,
such a dick.
I can't stand his stupid opinions and his Californian, you know, attitudes and God. So joining us from Florida, I guess, Mr. Mark Little, the non-Ricky Frankel.
This is kind of awkward, isn't it?
What?
Just heard that all, guys.
Wait, I don't think it's Mark, Adam.
Ricky, can you exclusively explain to the Punk News Podcast audience why you killed Mark Little and moved into his house and took over his podcasting equipment for us?
I don't know.
You don't have an answer.
I'm gonna choose to stay silent on that one.
He's a real psycho. Like, he doesn't even know why he does these horrible
he's
things.
Just like,
I just woke up in Florida. I don't know. But no, it is a freezing 65 degrees in Los Angeles right now. Not something I'm too happy. No. Yeah. I guess Mark had to bail out tonight.
Ricky,
we got you.
Ricky, how close do you live to the Sunset Strip?
Like 15, 20 miles.
Oh, okay, so kind of far.
Yeah.
But, so anyways, yeah. Hi, Ricky, how are you?
I'm good. Not in, I'm not in Florida, but I've been good.
You have something to be thankful for, then.
Yes. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
So tonight we're doing a podcast, guys, and we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. We have a demo that came out from Fugazi. We're going to make mention of some music that came out from Chumped that people are really excited about. We have some news about Billy Joe Armstrong doing another theater thing. Tragedy on the Dropkick Murphys tour. Some stories about meth, because, hey, we like meth. World Infernal Friendship Society had a record coming out. New music from Johnny Madcap. And a little autobiography put together by Keith Morris. So we're gonna cover a bunch of stuff. That stuff, basically. So anyways, I guess we'll start off here with Fugazi, which is not a band that we get a lot of news about these days. So we'll take anything that we can get. So the band is now streaming their archive release that they put out, which is called First Demo. It is the first demo, as the title says. The record officially came out on November 11th of this year. You can stream the whole thing on SoundCloud. Discord put the thing up there. So this is the first Fugazi demo. Did you guys give this a spin and check it out?
I did, and as the Punk News listeners might know, I've been on the fence about Fugazi for a while. I used to not like Fugazi at all. Then I kind of softened on them. I listened to this release. I dug this release. I'm still not a Fugazi maniac, but I guess a couple of things became apparent to listening to this demo. First of all, Fugazi really is super duper influential. Like, pretty much every punk band after Fugazi that did not do straight ahead punk is influenced by Fugazi. Like, Refused is mega influenced by Fugazi. One of my favorite bands, paradoxically, Ink and Dagger, is totally influenced. I mean, Ink and Dagger just does Fugazi like twice as fast, but they are so influenced, and I love Ink and Dagger. I thought the sound on this release was really, really good. I really like how Fugazi really mastered the concept of dynamics, and that sometimes they're quiet, and then sometimes they're really loud, and it goes back and forth and stays interesting throughout. And also, I gotta say, I guess because so many bands have been influenced by Fugazi, it's hard to recognize, and 1987, 1988 is from this demo, is how unique Fugazi really was in 1987, 1988. 1987, 1988 really was the tail end of the end of the hardcore punk era, or the, like, you know, like kind of like SSD Control, those kinds of bands. It was like the end of that era before, you know, we had like the early 90s New York hardcore scene and like the early 90s Jawbreaker scene and all that kind of stuff. So Fugazi really was extremely unique and more complex than their contemporaries. That being said, I dug this release, but every song is kind of the same tempo, more or less. And a lot of the songs were 4 and 5 minutes, so I don't know if it had enough variety in it for me really to become a huge fan. I enjoyed this. I thought maybe they could do more variety, maybe a few more tricks, although, to be fair, this is just a demo, and as a demo, it sounds great. I mean, honestly, it doesn't even sound like a demo. It sounds like an album, you know? I enjoyed this. Still not a Fugazi maniac, but I'm softening on Fugazi.
I'm slowly becoming more and more of a Fugazi fan, and I loved this alternative version of Merchandise. I can't get enough of it. I love the piano in it. Like, it just has a great build up to the already awesome chorus. So I'm on board with this. I might get this on vinyl, actually.
Yeah, for a demo recording, this sounds pretty decent. I mean, it's not a, you know, something that they did on a tape recorder, right? Like, it's clearly, you know, it was clearly done in a studio, and it sounds good enough that they could have went and released a lot of this stuff. I think part of what makes this such an interesting listen is that these aren't songs that we've heard a lot in different forms. I mean, outside of live recordings and things like that. So you look at a song that is really known for being so incredibly tight. So you look at something like Waiting Room, and especially like the proper studio version of Waiting Room, and then you listen to it here, and like the fact that you know the timing on the drums doesn't match up to what the version that we've all kind of known over the years is super distracting. Actually, I mean, it's really fascinating to see like how they took that and took the recording of it from this demo, which would have been perfectly fine, I think, in the hands of another band, and then took it and just, I don't know, like racketed up the tension and the timing and everything to what it became on the actual record. I think is super neat. So it's really cool hearing some of these songs. I agree though on Merchandise. I think it's a great version of it here. It sounds really good. So yeah, this is cool. I'm actually, John, I'm really fascinated. I don't know why I addressed you here, because I'm going to talk about history, and I guess you're the historian. But John, I am incredibly fascinated with 1988, around that time, because I was too young then. But when you look at the bands that influenced the stuff that we listen to, It's an era that's not that far back. Like, it doesn't feel like it's that far back in music history, but it straddles that kind of weird line between like things that are more nominally classic punk and things that to me were contemporary. So you, like, I look at a band like, say, like Husker Du, right? Their entire recorded output was out before 88, and they, to me, are, you know, of the last of that line in the sand I'm drawing where I consider something to be like more like historic. Mm-hmm. And then like in 88, you've got so you've got this demo came out, and then the proper Fugazi studio albums that followed it. But at the same point in the same year, you had things like Surfer Rosa and Come On Pilgrim from the Pixies, which was also super influential in the 90s. So you had like the Pixies at the same time kind of starting to do their thing. And you had like the Replacements were into their career, but they were like releasing those later records and everything. And it's just that that era is like the bridge to me between, I don't know, what I came to know as, you know, modern punk rock and alternative music in like 94, 95, you know, and the stuff before it. It's such an interesting era to me because it's, I don't know.
Well, I agree 100%. And actually, like, let's jump over the pond to England. If you look over to England, like, UK subs are kind of at the end of their original run. You know, Anti-Nowhere League is kind of, like, slowing down. So all these original, like, pounding UK bands are kind of fading away. Amoebics released their last record. So 88 really is kind of an important year between, it was, like, the last hurrah of the originators or the early guys and the creation of what we call post-punk or, you know, later day. Well, I mean, post-punk has been around since punk, you know, but the, I guess, what we call more modern, perhaps less hallowed bands, if you will.
Yeah, so I don't know, there's something about that year that is just incredibly cool to me and that is incredibly interesting. And I don't know, someone needs to go make a documentary about that.
Query, and I encourage the listeners to put forth any conspiracy theories they have. Why would Fugazi make an album quality demo if they're just going to release it on their own label?
That doesn't seem like that much of a conspiracy theory kind of thing, but sure. Yes, write us.
Well, what I'm implying is why would Fugazi need to make an album quality demo at all?
You're thinking that the guys from MCA were like sitting there at the door going, where's our demo? Our demo, Ian? Come on.
I don't think that, but I'm willing to entertain those conspiracy theories.
All right. Yes. So if anyone knows that, podcast@punknews.org is where you can get a hold of us and tell John that he's nuts. So anyways, Fugazi demo's out. You guys should go check it out. Something else that's out that people are really stoked about is the new record from Chumped. The album is called Teenage Retirement. It's due out on November 18th, which is, what, yesterday? As of recording this. And people really seem to be into Chumped. It's a Brooklyn band. They've had a ton of... I feel like they've had a ton of hype over the past year with, what is that other band they've done a lot of touring with that I cannot pronounce the name of?
Oh, not Beach Slang.
No, I might be totally conflating two things that shouldn't be. Was that like Watch the Toxie band or whatever?
Oh, Waxahachie. Or is that a Philly band? Waxahachie. Yeah, actually, that is it. That's one of the Katie Crutchfield of the Crutchfield Fishers of P.S. Eliot. They did play together a lot. You are correct, good sir.
All right. I remember hearing them in the same voice quite a bit. So anyways, Chumped Record's out. A lot of people like the Chumped Record. I'm not sure myself, but I've only really given it a cursory listen at this point. What do you guys think of Chumped?
For me, this was kind of on the too poppy side, but I didn't hate it. I'm not gonna decimate a band that doesn't deserve it. They're talented, but I just don't. I'm just not into it. I don't hate it though.
I tend to agree with Ricky. I hate being the old man, and I gave this a spin. It's acceptable, and I don't mean to be a dick. I mean it's not bad. It just, when I listen to punk, you know, give me the super fast, mean stuff. Give me the stuff that rocks the hell out. Give me the stuff that's super slow and heavy. This just kind of seems to be like slightly noisier radio rock to me. I didn't hate it. There seems to be a lot of music like this. And so what makes this special? How does this challenge me? How does this excite me?
Yeah, and I guess I'm coming in at about that wavelength right now. I put on a record like this, and it seems fine. Like, I'm not offended by it or anything. I'm sitting there in my office doing my work, and a Chumped record is playing, and you know, I'm not turning it off out of disgust or anything like that. But once it's done, I drift away, and I'm not that clued back into it. I think part of it for me is that, and I hate to make this connection based purely on having a female vocalist, but like, I listen to a band like this, and I think about like how much I liked like Fifth Hour Hero and Discount, and which had kind of a similar, well, Fifth Hour Hero was faster, but had that kind of similar distorted kind of jangly kind of poppy sound. And I don't know, this hasn't jumped out as like super distinctive to me. Again, I have a feeling that this is probably a band that has a really good live show, only because this is their first proper full length.
Correct, good sir.
Yeah, it is. So they've been a ton of people that's been talking about them over the past year on Punk News and elsewhere online, and that's got to be purely based on, you know, shows they've been playing and everything like that. So maybe it doesn't translate as well, but you know, I still want to sit down and give this another listen. It might open itself up, and I really like it, but so far I'm not sure.
Well, speaking of things that are opening themselves up, Billy Joe Armstrong is opening up his heart and doing a musical drama.
No,
god damn it.
We've been through this.
The musical drama will be him, famed comedian Fred Armiston, Judy Greer. The film is going to be called Geezer, and according to Variety, Geezer centers on the midlife crisis of a husband and father who, on his 40th birthday, decides to revisit his punk rock past by throwing an extravagant party in the presidential suite of the Drake Hotel, which apparently is punk rock. I guess my it seems to me that Billy Joe Armstrong seems to have like all these projects, but none of them come to fruition.
Oh, this seems like this is like someone took the other F Word documentary and made it into a play. I mean, I don't know what more can he do. What more can he do? He's successful. Like, Billy, we get it. You are a music god. We get it now. I even sat through a play, also the Green Day play too.
I saw the play.
I was just it was tough to get through.
You guys saw the Green Day play.
We got like my family's like, hey, we got free tickets from our friends. They're not able to see this. Do you want to go? I'm like, all right, fine. And it was tough, but I don't know why I don't know what this is set out to accomplish though. This project.
Well, I mean, would you penalize a person for trying to expand their art to different genres or different mediums, if you will? It sounds like
not after they impose like three albums on us already. Like,
so I mean, here's where I think this there might be a silver lining to this whole thing. If Billy Joel is, I don't know, a musical role in this film, but is not necessarily the front man, like the lead actor.
Yeah.
Then, hey, this might, I mean, like, I like Selma Blair. She was cool in the Hellboy movies. Everyone likes Judy Greer. You can't not like Judy Greer. Fred Armiston is funny, and, you know, he has some, you know, genuine music connections that we always like to reiterate whenever we talk about Fred Armiston. So I'm cool with all that. There's just something about, like, I feel that whenever Billy Joe's on stage, or whenever Billy Joe's doing anything, it's sort of just a Billy Joe ego vehicle. So, I mean, we led this story by saying Billy Joe Armstrong and a bunch of actors are going to be in this film, but we never did imply necessarily, and I am trying to find some confirmation of this, that Billy Joe is the lead in this film.
You will not find it because that is currently unknown.
Okay, so here's the thing.
I have a guess.
If Fred Armiston, who's an actual actor and has some timing and stuff,
he's cool.
If he's the lead, or hell, you don't need a male lead. Let like Selma Blair or Judy Greer or someone be the lead. That'd be all right. Maybe Billy Joe is just like, you know, playing in the hotel bar with a hat on and doesn't say anything.
I'm cool with eyeliner. That.
Yeah, he can have eyeliner, I guess. That's in his contract. It's in his rider.
Here's what my guess is. He's been tinkering around with acting, kind of under the radar a little bit, and I have two examples. One, he had a brief cameo in that Judd Apatow movie, This Is 40, and he also had a small role when American Idiot was on Broadway, on stage. So I wouldn't be surprised if he at least had a couple lines. I mean, in terms of the ego thing, maybe he'll even try and get the lead. I wouldn't be surprised.
If his lines were like, "Hello, sir, welcome to the Drake Hotel. May I take your bags?" And that's it, then that's okay.
I was thinking about this. And have you guys seen Scrooged with Bill Murray? Scrooged?
No.
Oh, God, a long time ago.
Well, you know who the taxi driver is in that movie?
Oh, I think I know. I forgot who it is. Who is it?
Adam?
When I say a long time ago, I mean like I was a child.
It's David Johansen of the New York Dolls.
Oh, cool.
And when I see Scrooge, I'm like, oh, awesome, it's David Johansen. But if I saw Billy Joe in a movie, I'd be like, oh, man, it's Billy Joe. And I wonder if it's just because, like, does Billy Joe pull me out of the movie fantasy because he is so identifiable? Like, he always looks like Billy Joe. Like, in Scrooge, David Johansen doesn't look like David Johansen, but I know because I know. I'm like, oh, it's David Johansen. And that's cool. But when I see Billy Joe, I'm like, oh, it's Billy Joe doing Billy Joe stuff again. Is that the difference? Or am I just partial to David Johansen because I love the New York Dolls?
Your disposition is that you would be partial to David Johansen anyways. So true. That's that. Now, going on IMDb here, which is never wrong, I don't actually see Billy Joe in the cast list.
But according to Variety, he writes and performs music in the film.
Sure, but that's putting this more in the "this could be fun" territory for me, because he's not like,
oh, I see.
This is clearly a film that happens to involve Billy Joe Armstrong in some musical role. It is not a Billy Joe Armstrong music. It's not a vehicle for his dramatic pursuits. So that's okay. I'm on board now. I want to see some details.
Apparently, Billy Joe has written two episodes of CSI.
Great.
And the Twilight Saga, and The Voices of the Philippines.
All of this is fantastic. what else are we talking about? What's next on the list here? Oh shit, tragedy. Okay. Not the band. So on a Saturday night, early Sunday morning, this past week, so this is early November when you're listening to this, whenever the hell we get it posted, the Dropkick Murphys were involved in a tragic accident after their show in San Antonio, Texas. The band was en route to the Tulsa show. While they were driving, a man apparently ran out into the road. He was struck and killed by the band's tour bus. Now, police are considering it a suicide right now, but the man, at least at the time an article went up, had not been identified. So following that, the band canceled their show that Sunday in Tulsa, and they are going to continue the tour, but they were, I guess, collectively pretty shaken up, and especially the guy that was driving their bus, and they did not have a way of getting all their stuff and their gear to that show, so that one was canceled and had to have been rescheduled. So anyways, that's pretty crazy.
I mean, the question is, the fact is, a lot of bands drive a lot, and so when you drive a lot, particularly in the winter, I mean, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the winter, but particularly in the winter, there's going to be you're at a higher rate of tragedy than you are if you're just a guy that doesn't drive all the time for your living. You know what I'm saying? So tragedy is going to happen to bands more often. The question is, how much responsibility do they need to take? How do they handle something like this respectfully And I gotta say, I mean, A, it's sad that this guy, let's just assume this guy wanted to commit suicide. It seemed like he did. It's sad that anybody would want to kill themselves. But this is not really the band's fault. I mean, somebody was going to hit him because the guy was trying to get hit by somebody. The fact that it was the Dropkick Murphys is pure coincidence. So I guess by not playing the next show, I say that's the proper amount of deference. And then they kind of got on with their own lives. It's sad, but it's not really the Dropkick Murphys' fault. So what can they do? What else can they do but say, oh, this is sad that it happened, and then kind of continue along their own way, you know?
Yeah, I think they handled it, I guess, as well as they could. I mean, it's what they were. Oh God, victims isn't the right word, but you know, they were kind of bystanders in this happening, right? They were in the bus. They weren't driving the bus, and they weren't.
Well, even it's not even the driver.
They weren't on the road. I mean, it's not even right. But they were, it could have been anyone's vehicle that was involved in this. It just happened to be them. I hate to say that too, because it's or imply that, because it's, you know, if this was a suicide, that's definitely not the driver's fault too, but that driver's got to live with that.
Yeah.
I gotta say, our commenters posted some weird ass shit that around under, I mean, they always do, to go with this. The one of them said that a better clickbait, headline would have been Dropkick Murphy's kill man, comma, cancel show. I guess.
I'm sorry. I
and then
be
someone
laughing.
Wrote a letter to the friends and family of the deceased from Al Barr, and this entire goofy letter that the person wrote is made up of Dropkick Murphy's song titles.
Oh my God.
And it seems like a lot of effort went into it, and it's not particularly funny, I guess, but
it's not, I mean, it's not that good of taste,
but it's not even on like a dark comedy level. It's not like, it's not that funny. It's just like, but it seemed like it did take a lot of effort. So I don't quite know. Our readers have a lot of surplus energy that they need to burn.
Well, that's kind of the point of punk rock. Spending a whole lot of effort for not a whole lot of result. That's kind of punk rock. Listen, I'm going to get serious for 1 minute here. We don't usually get serious on the Punk News Podcast, but I feel we should probably do this. I'm going to read the National U.S. Suicide Hotline, and they probably have one in Canada too. It's 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. So if you're having those kind of thoughts, don't do anything rash. Call that number. That's all I have to say. I thought it was appropriate to read it.
Yeah, we should. We're making jokes because we're assholes, but we're not trying to make light of that. I don't know what the Canadian number is.
You know, I mean, 1-800 number would probably work in Canada too. Let me see if I can pull up a Canadian one real quick.
But I don't know. Anyway, if you're in Canada, go to suicideprevention.ca or the outlaw. Where is the number?
Here it is. It's 1-905-688-3711.
Yeah, do that.
1-905-688-3711 in Canada.
Or in Ontario. That's an Ontario number. But anyways, yeah. Suicide.org on the internet has that info too. I bet you 1-800-SUICIDE works in Canada. I can't imagine it wouldn't. Anyways. Going to take a break? Play a song?
Let's play a tune. Let's clear the air and get back to the hijinks.
Okay. Well, all right. You want me to do this one?
Yeah, man. Kick us off.
Cool. I love when I find a band and a record that I really like, and then I go search for that band, and then I find out that someone reviewed them on Punk News like 6 months ago, and I didn't know. So that goes to show you I don't actually read our website. So there's a band out of Vancouver called Needles/Pins. I don't know. I guess you just call them Needles and Pins, but there's two slashes in their name. That's how they spell it. They released a full length this year, a 10-songer on Dirt Cult Records called Shamebirds. And it is a nice mix of snotty, really, really kind of like 70s New York sounding punk rock, with a little bit of the influence of those kind of post Buzzcocks modern bands that we like the Briefs and stuff like that. But there's a really kind of cool sneering quality to this that is not necessarily unlike, say, fellow Vancouver punk band the Black Halos that used to do back in the day. But anyways, though, I guess if you're out in BC, Needles and Pins are a big local cult band kind of thing. So this is from that record. I'm gonna play a song from here called High and Waiting / Cheap Cigarettes. So this is the fifth track off of the 10-track record Shamebirds by Needles and Pins. Check it out. Next story here on the Punk News Podcast, because this is about a stoner metal band, it is a John story. You want to do the read or you want to do the comments, sir?
I will.
Or you just want to take this and run?
I will. Adam, you read. I shall reply.
Okay. So, stoner metal legend Saint Vitus are on a European tour. However, recently, frontman Scott Wino Welrich was detained in Norway for allegedly possessing 11 grams of meth. So Wino was then deported back to the U.S. The band is continuing their tour with a skeletal lineup, and you can find the band's full statement on the website. I guess if you are looking to find out if the band is still playing this tour, they are, in whatever form that they can. And yeah, the by the way, the band's statement ends in caps lock. Fuck that weak shit. So, anyways, so John, two questions that come out of this. First of all, should I have known who Saint Vitus was before 20 minutes ago? And two, what happens when you're caught in Norway with 11 grams of meth and deported back to the U.S.?
First one, yes, but you don't lose that many points for not knowing it. Saint Vitus is a fairly important heavy metal band, even a fairly important punk rock band. A lot of people would argue, and I would agree, that Saint Vitus is the first doom metal band. And you say, what's doom metal, John? Doom metal is basically Black Sabbath-style heavy metal, specifically Volume 4-style heavy metal, specifically Supernaut-style heavy metal from Volume 4 by Black Sabbath. Bands heavily influenced by riff heavy, slow music. But on top of that, you say, John, well, that's heavy metal. This is punk rock. Why should I know about St. Vitus? Well, you say, who made St. Vitus St. Vitus? The answer is Greg Ginn. Greg Ginn, St. Vitus was one of the first bands to be signed to SST Records. They put out all their early records. So actually, St. Vitus was actually popular within the punk rock community before they were within the heavy metal community. Further, St. Vitus has remained friends with a lot of the Black Flag guys. Just recently, St. Vitus released a single, which is St. Vitus and Descadena. There's also another album of the St. Vitus guys and Chuck Dukowski and Mike Watt doing Blue Oyster Cult covers. So St. Vitus has always had a fairly tight connection to the punk rock scene. Henry Rollins is a huge fan. He plays him all the time on his radio show. So, second, what happens when you get detained in Norway for having 11 grams of meth? The answer is the complete opposite of what happens in the U.S. If you get caught in the U.S. with 11 grams of meth, I think you're going away for a long time. Now, I don't do meth. I've never done meth. Kids do not do meth. Meth is bad. But apparently, according to the commenters, and I believe them, 11 grams of meth is a lot of meth. Like, a lot of meth. And so if you get busted with that in the United States, you're going to wait for a while. In Norway, they throw you in jail for 11 days, say, okay, we'll let you complete the tour, then you can come back and complete 16 days of jail total. But instead, they just send you back to the States and forget about it. So the answer is not that much happens. If you get caught 11 grams of meth in Norway, they just send you home, which really that's – I mean, if you get busted for 11 grams of meth, that's a pretty easy sentence, you know, a lenient sentence. Wino says that he's currently in treatment, and he also says he's going to keep writing music and stuff. I will say, you know, St. Vitus is a doom metal band, so they're famous for loving weed, as most doom metal bands do and most stoner metal bands do. But, you know, meth's a whole other thing. Meth is very bad for you. I'm disappointed in Wino that he's doing meth or that he's done meth. I mean, he's a wild guy. He's a wild rocker. But you shouldn't be doing meth. And, I mean, it's not going to make good music, you know. So I would say, Wino, don't do meth. I would think better of you. But on the other hand, would I expect anything else of the guys in St. Vitus? They are wild rockers. So you got to take the claws with the cat, as they say. And that comes along with wild bands, even though St. Vitus is, I mean, they're getting up there in age.
If you Google the term 11 grams of meth, the first six articles are all about the St. Vitus. So they've really dominated that.
11 grams of meth.
Yeah, 11 grams of meth. Now, if you get onto this website that I just found and I'm probably on a list for visiting, and you want to figure out how much 11 grams of meth would cost. So it really depends on the country that you're in. Ooh. So if I'm looking down here in apparently in North Korea, it's only $11 a gram. Lithuania, $12 a gram. But if you look at Australia or New Zealand, $640 a gram.
Wow!
So
we should start importing meth.
Well, to the right countries, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the idea here is that punknews.org buys meth from the North Koreans, right? But then we sell the meth to to South Korea, because in South Korea, it's at $562 a gram.
We don't even have to
go that far.
We only have to drive like 3 miles.
All we need to do is create a tunnel under the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas, right? Because there's no one there, right? It's just full of mines and bears and shit. So we just need to figure out where the mines are. Don't step on the mines. Then we can go to North Korea. Get the meth, bring it to South Korea, and we make a ton of money.
We can get our own AMC show now.
Yeah, we can get like a cool name for it, like Meth Pirates or something.
Our show would just be like way more, you know, in Breaking Bad, it's like, you know, how they get all these networks together. So we just get shovels and carry meth 400 feet, you know?
Yeah, there's no scheme. We just dug a tunnel.
My favorite part of that list you gave, Adam, was don't step on the mines.
That is the first rule for crossing minefields, Ricky.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, like, let's say the price...
That would be a good show, because it would be kind of like... On the one hand, you'd have your Breaking Bad stuff going on, but on the other hand, you'd have, like, some Hurt Locker shit happening. Because we'd have all these mines and stuff that we would need to get, like, someone into one of those padded suits to defuse.
Can we have hijinks? I would have hijinks on our show, though, too.
Yeah, yeah. This is a good idea. And write this down.
And you know, we could do it like Clerks. Like while we're carrying meth, we could have like in-depth discussions about punk rock instead of Star Wars. You know, like what's the best Misfits album? Who gets to be Randall? I think. Let's see. Who's Randall? Who's Dante? And well, I guess there's only and who's Silent Jay? No, Bob. Silent Bob. And who's Jay? There's only three of us.
There must be more characters in that movie. I'm trying to think who else is in that movie.
Are you guys counting Clerks too? There's also that what was his name? Now I gotta look this up. Hang on.
Clerks 2, like the donkey.
Well, anyway, while we're talking about Clerks, World Inferno Friendship Society, they are streaming their new album because it's out already. The new album is called This Packed Funeral. I checked it. I liked it. But Ricky Frankel, I believe you just saw World Inferno for the first time last week or so. Did you enjoy the experience? Did you enjoy this LP, this long player?
I have so much to say. First of all, this past week in terms of...
Oh, did you wear a suit? Did you wear a suit?
I didn't. It was too much. When I tell you what happened at the show, believe me, it was better that I didn't wear a suit. But this week... was
fantastic. Did you at least wear a shirt with a collar, you fucking animal?
No, actually, a lot of people didn't. Only one person was, I think only like one person was in a suit. But anyway, this past week was amazing for live shows. I saw Bad Religion the Sunday before. Then I saw Pairs live on Wednesday. Then the next day I saw World Inferno Friendship Society. John, thank you for telling me not to miss the Misfits because, oh my God, this was so much better.
I told you to miss the Misfits.
Yeah, so I was able to sell my ticket for face value, which is fine. But oh my God, that was an experience more than a concert. That was so cool.
You sell your ticket for face value?
Yeah, I needed to get rid of it. It was only like a
that was your day. Experience?
No. That was for the Misfits ticket that I had to get rid of.
I'm trying to catch him in a verbal faux pas, Adam, but he's not taking the bait.
Nope, I'm not. Anyway, I went to Los Globos to see them. I got there really early because in order to miss traffic here, you have to leave really, really early. So I got there. I was like first in line, and I had to park my car like three blocks away from the venue because they didn't have like a parking lot or anything like that. But I did. I met their drummer outside. I'm like, hey, if I run the three blocks to get my album, will you sign it for me? And she said, yeah. And so I ran the three blocks. And this is where not having the suit came in. And the whole band signed it. And they were really cool. I got to talk with Jack for a little bit, who was really cool. And then I ran back and put my album in the car. So having a suit would have been just awful. And also got really hot. Inside, I actually have the set list if you want to hear it of the show.
Rip through it, Ricky. Rip through it.
All right, Tattoos, Lust, Thumb Cinema. They did a couple new ones. They did what's it called? American Mirror, Mercurial.
Yeah.
Mercurial, Robeson, Second Chance. I'm just reading off the list of what they wrote. Rick's Puppies, which I think is
that Cats Are Not Lucky's Creatures?
I know. I think that one is taken down a peg. I help out the squatters in the subway.
Oh, okay.
Which is my favorite song off the new one they did. Jake and Eggers, Politics of Passing Out, Go Faster, Rat, Velocity of Love, Zen, and then they did for the encore. They did Witches, Younger, and Addicted to Bad Ideas.
That's a badass set. I'll tell you. That's a really badass set.
I was really happy with it. I would have loved Me versus Angry Mob, but anyway.
How was the show though? Explain to the audience what the show itself was like.
The show was. I mean, what was interesting was one of the opening bands was called Jailed Weddings, and they were kind of like
That's a Burner Records band.
They were like a less punk version of World Inferno, I thought. They have like two, and they were cool. I really liked them. But then World Inferno came on, and it was just like, I don't know. It was just, if you're really into this band, it's just it's like I went through something than a concert. It was absolutely phenomenal. So if you can see them, check it out. But what's his name? Sorry, Jack was like, all of them were drinking a lot. Jack finished off a bottle of wine and kept, you know, drinking whiskey. And he was loving interacting with the crowd and everything, grabbing people's hands, bringing people on stage, you know, playing. I guess he played acoustic guitar during Politics of Passing Out. It was really, really cool. And I would see them again. I gave him a little shit, like just for fun. I just said, oh, so what are you doing here in Los Angeles? Because I know you don't like it here or whatever. And yeah, but it was cool. I was surprised they didn't rip on Los Angeles at all for not liking California.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time, Ricky. I love World Inferno. I think they're one of the most unique bands there is.
Absolutely.
And people should definitely check them out. Adam White, where do you stand on the Inferno, the world, the WIFS?
I've been away from this band for a while. So, like, my main, like, I own a copy of Red Eyed Soul on vinyl, but, like, that's sort of it. So I hadn't really followed what was going on or what their other releases were or what their recorded output was or anything like that. But that said, I really like what I've heard from this record. When I went to listen to this, there was only three songs. It wasn't the full thing, so I haven't heard it all. But I really like this. I want to hear the whole thing. It reminds me a lot of, and this is going to be totally uninteresting to anyone but me, it reminds me a lot of a few solo artists that I've really gotten into in the past few years. So I'm really running on the same wavelength as this. So I'm super into the songs that I've heard. I have to get this full thing when it comes out. And it is probably end of year list material for me, but whoa. I don't want to say that without having heard it. But yeah, I'm really into it.
It is for me. I pre-ordered this album and got it. I think it came like a week early, which was really cool. But it's been on my record player ever since. I absolutely love it.
Well, there you have it, kids. World Inferno is Punk News approved. Let's do an Adam White style story here. We actually didn't do this on Punk News. Maybe we'll do an article. Maybe we won't. But the Billboard 200, they're slightly changing how they – well, not slightly. They're majorly changing how they rank albums. Beginning with the top 10 for Wednesday, December 3, Billboard is going to start tracking albums by album sales, but also they will now include on-demand streaming services and digital track streams. Basically, for every 1,500 streams counts as one digital album, so one album sold, and for every 10 digital tracks sold, it counts as one physical album sold. So I guess for the major artists, it's going to really shift number of units sold. Well, maybe not, actually. Anyway, Adam White, what do you think of the new way of tracking? And honestly, I kind of thought they already implemented this. I guess I was wrong.
Yeah, I assumed that they were factoring this stuff in the first place. I mean, Billboard is such a weird thing because even before digital music came into play, the fact that they were, you know, that they were gleaning their numbers basically off of SoundScan before this. So what SoundScan was, in short, was a system by which record stores were kind of basically reporting the totals at the register back to whoever ran SoundScan, is like the Nielsen ratings company or something like that. And then those numbers would be used to compile the Billboard charts. But there were ways to game that, and there were ways to manipulate it. And it was one of these, it was a weirdly imperfect system, but sort of the best that they had at the time. And they're replacing that with another weirdly imperfect system. I mean, there's all sorts of arbitrary things that are on here, especially, you know, how many streams we count as an album sale and whatever. I mean, none of that actually means anything. It's just, you know, something that the industry decided upon. So we're shifting from one weird arbitrary system that people for some reason care about to another weird arbitrary system that people for some reason care about. Because album sales have been down so much over the past number of years, it feels that like the Billboard placement isn't news anymore, but it was at the time. It was at a time, like, it used to be a big deal when, you know, some punk band that we cover would crack the 200. And I'm sure we would have posted stories about them doing that back in the day. But these days, like, no one sells records. No one. I mean, it was big news recently that Taylor Swift album that just came out went platinum, because it's the first thing to go platinum this year.
Yeah, insane. It's insane.
Yeah, and if you think back to the 90s, all sorts of shit was going platinum all the time.
I'm sorry. Let me just add one thing in there. Didn't she take her music off of Spotify too?
She did.
Yes. And if you want to learn more about that story, kids, go look at the article that Billy Bragg wrote about it. Because she took her album off of Spotify and made a big amount of noise about how, you know, oh, Spotify doesn't pay artists, and she's, you know, making some sort of stand for artist rights and blah, blah, blah. Bragg calls her out on it, where it's like, no, that has nothing to do with it. She's made some sort of deal with Google to have her music on whatever Google's streaming service, what's it called, Key or something like that, that they announced recently. And this is nothing more than, like, corporate, you know.
Nah, screw Billy Bragg. I'm with Taylor Swift on this one. And I'm not even a huge Taylor Swift. Although, actually, I don't like her music, but I do respect her, because more and more we've had a sexualization of young girls, and Taylor Swift isn't even that young, but she seems young. You know, she seems like she's 17, though she's like 26. And so I like that Taylor Swift can kind of represent the wholesome young girl, if you will. You know, I mean, she's not completely non-sexual, but she's not, you know, wearing nothing but bikinis or whatever on stage. She doesn't objectify herself.
I don't know what this has to do with the topic.
I'm getting to that. is Billy Bragg's being a dick. And here's why Billy Bragg, as usual, Billy Bragg's being a dick. And here's why. It's because Taylor Swift is saying, I own my music, or, you know, my label owns my music. So instead of me, you know, just kowtowing to Spotify and letting him give me 45 cents, I'm going to take my music and sell it to a higher bidder. Therefore, I am asserting more control over my music. Therefore, I am asserting that an artist does have control over the music that they create. So I support Taylor Swift. If she wants to sell it exclusively to one digital service, that's great, as long as she's getting what she feels is a fair deal, as opposed to the ridiculousness of Spotify that is really just a inverse supply and demand paradigm, if you will. And I'm just using the word paradigm because I don't know how to phrase it, and I'm just trying to make myself sound smarter than I am. So anyway, Billy Bragg is boo-hooing because anytime any major label person does anything ever, he's like, they're being jerks. No, I'm sorry, Billy Bragg, you're being a jerk. At least Taylor Swift, who is a person of some influence in music, is making some sort of stand about artists controlling their own music. So, Billy Bragg, I'm giving you two thumbs down on this one.
I would have been happier if you'd just avoided streaming altogether, but I didn't know about that Google part of it.
That's apparently what's going on here. So I don't know. Anyways, point being, I saw this news crop up right before the podcast, and I just wanted to bring it up because I think it's interesting, and I'm curious if the numbers that they're going to start to report, are they going to shift things at all in favor of the kind of stuff that we report on? I'm curious about that. And B, is it going to make Billboard, I guess, relevant from a news standpoint again? People going to trust these numbers?
May I give predictions?
Sure.
With Billboard, originally the idea is to track sales, and I think the purpose was to track popularity, so you could see who's the most popular artist, if you will. It also gave insight into business, what artist is making the most money. Now with streams, you know, that's not a whole lot of influence. I mean, it's really more tracking popularity than it is business power or business acumen. However, 1,500 streams is actually a significant amount of streams. I mean, if we look at most punk bands, if you look at their YouTube, most punk bands don't even have 1,500. So let's say they hit 1,500, that's one album sold. If we look at one of the biggest indie bands, Death Grips, they max out at about 120,000, right? So that would be, let's see, that's 100 albums, right? So that's barely nothing, you know what I mean? I mean, so I don't think that will influence it much at all. However, digital music sales will influence a great amount, particularly with major label artists, where, you know, it's a singles market. It's no longer an albums market. And who sells the most singles? Major label artists. So I think you'll see an even widening gap between our kind of music and major label music. So I think this is actually going to shove our music further on down the list. Not that it really matters.
Yeah, I have two things to add here. I didn't really see how this is exactly relevant to, like, us and me. I mean, a lot of the music I listen to probably wouldn't have gotten on the Billboard 200 anyway. So, and I just like it. And I like the, there's something about the fact that some bands just aren't popular and I only like a certain amount of people know them, kind of makes it special. And like, oh, we know that there's something even better going on that most of the general public is ignoring.
Hanson, right? Hanson.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I don't know, how did they get to the number 1500?
Good question.
I guess that's,
I wish they had just said that in this article, because that seems kind of like a number they pulled out of, you know, thin air.
Trying to actually measure popularity of music in any way that is systemic is more or less a bunch of BS anyways. So yeah. Why not just come up with imaginary numbers? I mean, it's one thing to chart sales, but charting sales doesn't chart listens, right? Like, there's certain albums I've bought that I listened the hell out of, and there's some that I bought and I listened to once. So... Yeah. I don't know.
You
know. Really, what we need is some sort of all-encompassing satellite that monitors what all the humans are doing all the time, and then it could make an accurate count.
Let's send Adam to the UN and let's see if we can get it done.
And then exterminate our enemies. All right. So speaking of things that I wish a satellite laser would blow up. Johnny Madcap and the Distractions have posted a video for the song Bad Decisions. Johnny Madcap was formerly, of course, of the band Madcap, and the song blends an Elvis Costello-influenced rock with some classic new wave, and you can check the video out on Punk News. Now, I'm not anti-Johnny Madcap.
I don't know, say you hoped you got blown up, sounded pretty anti.
I hope, no, yeah, hold on. From a musical standpoint, I have nothing wrong with this band. This song was fun. I'm okay with that. This video, however, was creepy and gross, and I didn't like it, and I want a fucking laser to blow it up, is what I want.
See, I do not
want to look at some dude's teeth for, like, 2 minutes.
See, I'd love this video. Like he's chained to a chair, strapped to a chair, and while he's there, like, people are picking his nose, and then he pulls, like, a hand grenade, he drops acid. I thought this video was extremely well done for a low-budget video. I dug this track. You know, this track isn't mega inventive. It's basically Elvis Costello-type music. I dug it. I put this on the news item for a couple reasons. A, I think the tune is cool. I dig this tune. I think the video is really, really funny. But also, you know, I came aware of Johnny Madcap because he sent me an email a little while ago and he asked me to review it. Not that Punk News is any huge influential institution, but the point is if you are a band or whatever, you should not send form letters, but personal letters, don't have to be long, to people that you want to check out your music. And the odds are against you, but every once in a while, you'll hit the reviewer or the editor or whatever, and they'll dig your music and they'll put it online, so... I don't know what that gets you, but hey, I dug this track, and I'm glad Johnny Madcap said to me, check out my track.
Yeah. The man is fine. I didn't like his teeth, and it was weirding me out.
I hope Johnny Madcap gets blown up by a satellite. But nothing against him. You know, no hate,
no,
bro.
No,
no.
That's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes, you got to get blown up by a satellite.
You really didn't like this video, though, for real?
I think conceptually it was a fun video. I was just kind of getting creeped out.
Fair enough.
I really like this. It's so much so that I ordered the 7-inch.
Well, there you go.
But here's the thing. It's interesting that this is on now because he was actually on the Anxious and Angry podcast that Ryan Young does, and they were talking. There's you can order the half red, half blue 7-inch at the link we've provided, but Ryan is also through Anxious and Angry putting out this EP, and there's a splatter, like a it's half red, half blue with the black splatter on it, which is like another option on his website. So I got that one, but I thought this was really cool. I like the video. I was surprised at how much I liked the song though, because I had not heard of him, and apparently he's fairly local around here. Apparently he grew up in, like, Glendale, so I should have known more about him before.
Madcap, back in the day, was, I want to say, on Side One Dummy, maybe?
Oh, that one makes sense.
I think it's kind of hard to say. Yeah, all right. Madcap was... I felt bad for those guys a lot because they were banned.
I hope this guy gets blown up. I felt bad for him too.
No, I did because they sounded like they were having so much fun on their records. They sounded like their hearts were really in it. And they had this kind of like being in a punk rock band was just a joy for them. And you could tell, but their music didn't, or at least not even their music, but the band's image, the way that they were sold, whatever it was, did not seem to grab anyone. And they were always, they always came across kind of like the cleaner, less gritty version of stuff that was going on like Hellcat or Disaster Records or stuff like that. Mm. But they rarely seemed to run in those circles. Like they'd occasionally be listed on bills on those shows, but like it never felt like they were like, you know, in the Tim Armstrong crew kind of thing, the way that some bands were. I like seeing them pop. I like seeing this come up because I was like, oh hey, Madcap, hey, they're still doing stuff, cool. I mean, it's not the band, it's Johnny, but anyways, yeah. I mean, I like Johnny Madcap. I think this video should be shot with a space laser, not Johnny Madcap himself.
Well, there you have it. Speaking of a person that should not be shot with a space laser, speaking of a person that should be preserved and protected and cherished, Keith Morris, lead singer of Black Flag, lead singer of Circle Jerks, lead singer of Bug Lamp, lead singer of Midget Handjob, lead singer of Off, is putting out an autobiography, not for a little while though. It's coming out in fall of 2016, and it's going to be called My Damage, 40 Years on the Front Lines of Punk, and it's going to be co-written with Jim Rulins, and I'll let you guys take this off. But I want to say is we had some smarty pants on the Facebook say, if it's being written with someone, it's not an autobiography, it's a biography. Incorrect. A biography is written about someone without their participation. An autobiography quite often has a co-writer so that the actual subject can have their thoughts more streamlined or broken down into readable segments, much like Keith Richards' autobiography, much like Billy Idol's autobiography, much like Alice's Bag's autobiography. Pretty much any other music autobiography has a co-writer. I just had to point that out there. Take it away, Adam. Take it away, Ricky.
I want to read this. I think it sounds cool. Like I need to catch up on some of these. I want to read Henry Rollins' biography, but I'll wait for this one. I'm looking forward to this, and I'm seeing Off on the 29th. So
nice.
I'm seeing them at the Echo, so I am excited for that.
Nice.
And that's also another album that'll probably be on a lot of end of the year lists too.
I have nothing in particular that's interesting to say about this. This looks like it'd be really cool. I'd look forward to reading it. I think that, you know, any of the books that have, well, I'm going off the one. I was a huge fan in my youth of Get in the Van by Rollins, right? So, and you know, I'd love to see, you know, a few more perspectives, a few more of the guys of, you know, what happened in Black Flag, especially before Rollins came around, because that was my main historical touch point, because that's what I had read. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Be cool.
See, that's not how I see it all. I don't see this as a companion again, my man. I see this as the essential. I mean, if you read any interview with Keith Morris, he just goes on and on about all these super interesting things. He'll just, like, mention one thing in a fragment that actually is, like, a super-duper interesting thing, like, about how Bill Stevenson of the Descendants, you know, first started working at his dad's bait shop, or that he and Darby Crash were driving down the highway once, and he tried to jump out of the car, and Darby Crash, you know, grabbed him by his pants and pulled him back in. Or how about how he and Ron Reyes almost killed David Lee Roth once. I cannot wait to read this. This will probably be my number one punk rock autobiography of all time. And I got to say, I'm jealous, but I have to give props to Jim Rulin, because, you know, I've interviewed Keith Morris 8 times, I think. And I wonder, if I just asked, could I have been the guy that did Keith Morris' autobiography? Or maybe he knows this guy, I don't know, you know? So I could have struck on this one, or at least I could have taken a shot. And I just didn't think to. And I'm jealous, but I'm happy that Jim Rulins, I'm sure he will do a good job.
You know, actually, it's a lot. I'm going to just answer your point real quick, Don. It's actually easier than it sounds.
What is?
To to start writing someone's biography. My dad just asked, he's starting to do one. He's starting to write a biography of an artist he loves. And he asked the artist's, widow, and the estate if they would give him the rights to do it. And they did. It's that simple.
Yeah. Thanks, Ricky. Thanks. Thanks, man. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, what do we got? Are we done? We're done.
Should we play a tune?
Do you have a tune?
Yeah, I got two choices you guys can pick from. Do you guys want to hear a modern avant-garde hardcore band, which I enjoy, doing a unusual take on a soul classic? Or do you want to hear an obscure new wave band from England from the 70s?
I'll take A.
I was going to go B, so... It's up to you.
Let's do them both. You know why? Because the first one's super short. The first one is the band Chodo Ghetto, which is a band, I think they're from L.A. They're a very unusual avant-garde hardcore band. They put out one of my favorite hardcore records. I think it was 2 years ago. Well, a little while ago, not super recent, a little while ago, they put out 18 covers of love songs. One of their covers is Cupid by Sam Cooke, but there's like their version of like 30 seconds. But this is Chodo Ghetto doing Cupid, originally by Sam Cooke, although I don't think Sam Cooke wrote it. And then after that, we're going to hear a band called the Fabulous Poodles. And you say, John, who's the Fabulous Poodles? The answer is a band from England that almost nobody in the U.S. knows about. And the only reason I know about them is because I bought them from the dollar bin. And they have, I think, two records, but really four, because they switched all the tracks around the U.S. Anyway, the Fabulous Poodles are a really neat band, kind of dark but very poppy sounding. And they've got like all these really dark subject matters but very poppy, fun tunes. So I was going to play that song, but we probably shouldn't now. Let's do Vampire Rock. This is after Chodo Ghetto doing Cupid. This is Fabulous Poodles doing Vampire Rock.
Swirling round the stones, somewhere off wild creatures moan. The graves are opening one by one. They always shy the light of sun. Faded robes go spinning round, feet that never make a sound. Lightning flashes, thunder roars, and winds are flapping on the doors. It's a vampire rock, and they're out for your blood. Sirens call. Don't get invited to the ball. Don't be deceived by lauded flesh, 'cause you won't get no SOS. And don't you touch no doctored wine. You won't be singing Auld Lang Syne. They leave no shadows when they dance. You should have split, you've got no chance. Their drifted fangs will get you now. Vampire rock and roll, vampire rock and roll. is raging, keep your grip. Don't heed the lure of vampire lips. The bats are circling round and round to run the troubled mind to ground. They're everywhere, it's hard today. They're moving fast, they're here to stay. They'll bleed you dry of every drop and hunt you till you gotta stop.
We're back. Two songs from John. Do you want to give them the titles again, just so that they know what we played there?
That first track was Cupid, a Sam Cooke cover by Chodo Ghetto, and the second was Vampire Rock by the Fabulous Poodles. And if you see that dollar, if you see that record in the dollar bin, even the $5 bin, pick up that record if you like new wave. It's fresh.
All right. Well, that about does it for this week on the Punk News Podcast. Thanks, John. Thanks, Ricky. Yep. Ricky. We forgive you for not being Mark Little.
I don't.
Yeah, you know what? Always nice to feel appreciated.
We remember your name.
That's good. Yeah. It's getting there.
All right. That's does it. If anyone wants to email us, podcast@thepunknews.org is how you do that. See you guys next week.